It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll hear about a new investigation into fugitives fleeing the state and why a growing number of them won't be pursued by law enforcement beyond the state's borders.
First, there's been a lot of news on the cybersecurity front this week. We heard yesterday that the Twitter account of the U.S. Central Command had been hit by hackers. Today, President Obama is proposing legislation that would encourage sharing between government agencies and the private sector to help improve cybersecurity. And of course, all of this comes on the heels of North Korean alleged cyber attacks on Sony Pictures Entertainment.
But as businesses and governments try to get ahead of the next cyber attack, our guest has some concerns as to how Wisconsin is progressing. In a recent op-ed, he says the state is behind the curve in producing, attracting, and retaining the kind of cybersecurity talent needed by companies and institutions of all sizes. He says that's not only a problem for national security, but for a state's economy, too.
Joining us now is Tom Still. He's the president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Veronica. Glad to be on.
Well, you say that cyber attacks aren't just about threats to national security. They're also about issues of economic and cultural stability. Why should we pay attention to those last two along with the national security?
Well, and today there's a blurring of the lines between what might be considered defense and what might be an economic attack, because often those who really want to somehow get at America or get at our culture are going to do so through a cyber attack. By undermining our economy, I think that they can hope to accomplish a lot. And here in Wisconsin, if you look around at our sectors, healthcare, retail, financial services, insurance, energy, all of those are particularly vulnerable to cyber attack, and we need to just do a better job of recognizing that and preparing for it.
Why would you say that those sectors you just named are particularly vulnerable to cyber attack?
Well, if you look at some of the statistics on where cyber attacks are taking place, probably a third of them are related to the energy grid, where a lot of folks who have taken a look at that are very concerned. You can see that it's happened in the financial services industry. It has taken place in major retail outlets. Those have been well documented, from Home Depot to Target. And in healthcare, certainly there, the records of patients could be at risk in a cyber attack situation. So all of those sectors are where actually Wisconsin has strengths, and yet at the same time we need to make sure that we're prepared. And all of those sectors are doing what they can, but at the same time, they want to make sure they're attracting the kinds of folks who can carry out that work within their organizations and beyond.
Right, and you've said that the state's businesses are actually behind the curve in producing, attracting, and retaining the kind of cybersecurity talent that they need. So the question there is why? What is holding Wisconsin businesses back?
Oh, I think in general it's because not just a Wisconsin problem, but here it's a little more intense because of the nature of the kinds of businesses we have. But there's a huge competition going on for those types of workers. The U.S. Department of Defense alone expects to add about 6,000 employees in the cyber fighting workforce by 2016. So when you have certainly the federal sector really try to get all the talent that it can to handle this, that means that the competition is going to be there also with the private sector to attract some of those same kind of workers. And different folks have looked at this from afar and crunched the numbers about what kind of talent is going to be available. RAND did a recent report, so did the Global Information Security Workforce, so has McKinsey & Company. A variety of organizations have taken a look and said, wow, the rising demand, which is, of course, commensurate with the rising number of threats coming from abroad and internally, really add up to mean that there's just more competition for the kinds of people who are needed and not yet as many in the pipeline as we need to have.
Well, with this kind of competitive field that you're talking about, what do you think Wisconsin needs to do to stand out and draw these kinds of workers here to the state?
Well, I think some A couple of things. One of the things is we, through the Tech Council and one of our sister organizations, the Wisconsin Security Research Consortium, have been able to put together a facility that can help with training that will be built to the really the highest standards that would allow that kind of training and actual work and research to take place in a very secure setting. So that's new to Wisconsin, and we're very proud to have that coming online and, you know, within the next months. I mean, it's really poised to take effect. And I think that the various research institutions around the state, starting with the UW system, have taken a very intense interest in this. And then I think you can look at other states. In Michigan, for example, its Cyber Range project is really designed to do exactly the kind of thing that we're talking about, which is to work with businesses, to work with those who are in the cybersecurity field, and try to make sure that there is a good exchange of information and that the kinds of protections that need to be in place are in place and are constantly updated.
In terms of growing its own cybersecurity experts, is Wisconsin poised to develop this kind of talent here in the state, or is there some development here that's needed?
Oh, there's some development for sure that is needed. But in a broader sense, we're poised to do this. And again, it's because we have the right sectors in Wisconsin. The kinds of sectors that need to worry about cybersecurity the most are actually strong in this state. We have a great academic system, and I should say systems, in the sense from the Wisconsin Technical Colleges to the private colleges and universities to the UW system, that is turning out that the kinds of people who should be available for this workforce. We have, especially within some of those institutions, specific schools or departments or colleges that focus on this, computer science, electrical engineering, those kinds of fields. There is a discussion underway about creating a data science major within the UW system, which I think would be a welcome improvement. And finally, we have some other major companies in the state that are operating in a variety of sectors that recognize the need and have been doing what they can to try to attract those people. So it's while we're a bit behind right now, the potential to solve this problem is very strong.
Now, as you said, there are some new possibilities in the works here when it comes to cybersecurity research, including a new lab that will be opening at the University Research Park in Madison. What do you know about that new facility and what it might be doing and how it might contribute to the effort?
Sure. And that is the facility I referenced earlier that is managed through the Wisconsin Security Research Consortium, which is really a public-private effort and has been for a number of years as this process has come together. It involves folks from the university, from the private sector, from the University Research Park itself, from the Wisconsin Technology Council, my organization. And so it has put together a board and a staff that is gearing up for this. It's not the biggest facility in the world. It doesn't need to be because of the nature of cybersecurity, but it is built to the level of protection that makes it an ideal place to do training as well as research.
This is getting a lot of attention right now, especially at the national level as well. Given that, what do you think the nation's priorities should be as it considers preparedness for cyber attacks that could be coming down the pike in the future?
I think we need to look as a nation both abroad and internally. When you think just about some of the recent headlines, the Sony attack, I mean, whether that was actually carried out by North Korea or not, we know that came from abroad. We also know that the Syrian Electronic Army and some other units within Russia, within other places around the world, within China, are actively conducting cybersecurity attacks. It's well documented. It's known. That happens every day. It probably happens every minute. And if you see some of the traffic that goes on naturally, you know that it is definitely being watched by not only the U.S. security establishment, but by people in the private sector as well. Because, again, that blurring of the lines between what is a national defense attack and what is an economic attack is really pretty apparent right now. That those who want to do damage to the United States can do so by attacking our infrastructure or our economy. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have hackers from within, and that happens every day as well. So I think it's a combination of thinking what's going on abroad, what's going on right under our noses.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. He joined us to talk about addressing Wisconsin's cybersecurity talent gap.
We're taking a look at a new investigation from USA Today and Gannett, Wisconsin Media. It found that in the past year and a half, the number of fugitives who are not being pursued by authorities beyond Wisconsin's borders has increased by 29%.
The FBI database lists nearly 11,000 arrest warrants for suspects across Wisconsin. Of those, about 650 fugitives will not be returned to Wisconsin if they're found in another state. And some of those in question have committed serious crimes.
Joining us now to talk about the investigation is Shireen Seward. She's a reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. Shireen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thinking about, a fugitive, somebody's committed a crime in Wisconsin, they've fled across state lines. I guess my assumption is there's a warrant out for them. There's some kind of active effort to pursue them, track them down, bring them into the state if they're arrested elsewhere. Is that the norm?
Well, you would certainly think so, but that is not the norm. In fact, 648 fugitives, as you mentioned, are not being returned to Wisconsin if they're found in another state. And that does include 33 that are accused of committing some very violent crimes. We're looking at rapes and armed robberies and burglaries. They're not being pursued. So they can avoid prosecution simply by staying out of the state.
So I guess the big question is why? Why aren't they under some kind of extradition thing if they're arrested in another state?
Well, and that is a good question, and that's what we tried to take a look at. And it seems that the answer varies from county to county. Every county has its own set of priorities and its own set of procedures with respect to how these warrants are entered into the system. And they are just different from county to county. And that's why when you take a look at the list, most counties, Outagamie, Brown, Manitowoc, Fond du Lac, they just have a handful of these warrants where suspects won't be pursued. And many counties have none. But then you look at others, Portage, Marathon, Wapaka counties, they each have dozens on the list. And you look at the list, and many of them are misdemeanors. They are very low priority crimes, if you would. Perhaps they bring them back here and they'd pay a $200 fine and end up in jail for a few days. But then there are those that don't fall into that category that certainly you would think that prosecutors would want to bring them back here.
Well, let's stick with those misdemeanors, those lighter crimes for a moment. Is it the case that it would cost more to actively pursue these people and have them on this extradition list or however that works than it's worth?
That is certainly the response that I got from prosecutors and from judges. It does cost a lot of money. Even to bring a suspect from a neighboring state, such as Illinois or Minnesota, it costs thousands of dollars to bring that suspect back here. So when you're talking about cost and you're talking about a crime that what are they going to get out of it? Are they going to reap the rewards of having this person come back here, or is it simply going to be a significant financial drain on the system? And they really have to play a balancing act here when they make those decisions for those misdemeanors.
And is this up to different prosecutors in different counties? They're the ones who are making the call?
It seems like the judges are the ones who are making the call, although prosecutors can have a say in that process. And I talked to a couple of prosecutors who said, maybe we need to be a little bit more proactive in what we talk to the judge about and what we say to the judge. And in some counties, the judge basically checks a box that says it's they're extraditable or not extraditable. That's not the case in all counties. It's not the case in Brown County, for example, but it is the case in Portage County on the other end of the spectrum.
Now let's get into those more serious crimes that we set aside a moment ago. What are some of the cases out there where somebody's committed a serious crime, they're out of the state, and that box wasn't checked or whichever procedure it is, and so even if they're arrested somewhere else, they're not going to be brought back here to Wisconsin?
Well, there are a couple of cases that really piqued our interest. One, actually, my fellow I-Team reporter Eric Lickey reported on back in March. It was also a Portage County case, Dennis Jones, a former Wisconsin fugitive. He had been wanted for 7 years for rape. He had been in and out of Texas jails, but basically, authorities were powerless to bring him back to Wisconsin because the warrant for his arrest was non-extraditable. After that story ran, the Portage County District Attorney did fix that warrant. He was served. He did appear in court via video feed. But unfortunately, after 7 years, the witness could no longer identify him, and they were forced to drop those charges. But there is another Portage County case as well, a man who's accused of selling heroin in a near-fatal overdose. He's accused of two felonies, and he's being charged as a habitual offender. That's a provision that tacks on additional time because he has several earlier criminal convictions. But he can avoid prosecution by staying away because that is a non-extraditable warrant for his arrest.
So if this person gets arrested in Rockford, Illinois, mm-hmm. say, because Absolutely. This is non-extraditable, he would not be brought back to Wisconsin for a prosecution.
That's right, unless the Portage County prosecutor goes back and takes another look at this, and we have been told that he is planning to do that.
So why, you can understand, as you were explaining earlier, a lesser offense, more trouble than it's worth, more cost than it's worth, but for a more serious crime like the two you just mentioned, what was the reasoning offered when you brought these up to prosecutors, to judges?
You know, I have to tell you that there was no clear answer. I got a lot of, oh, I didn't know. We weren't aware of that. We weren't aware that that was happening. We'll take another look at it. I think, to be honest with you, it's a case of people having to pay a little bit closer attention to how each of these cases are handled. I will say, though, there are some of those offenses where prosecutors know exactly where those offenders are. There are some Marathon County cases, for example, where there are three sex offenders on the list who have failed to register, and those three suspects have already been deported. So prosecutors know that they're not in the country anymore. But it really varies by case.
And the process varies, as you mentioned, from county to county. Is there a standard system for revisiting the initial decision as to whether or not this warrant is extraditable?
I don't think there's a standard process, but prosecutors will have to take it upon themselves to take a look at those warrants and revisit that with a judge to change that extradition order.
This is all county by county. Is there any kind of state element, part of a bureaucracy or anything that is in charge of supervising this, watching what's going on in the counties?
Not really. Each county is pretty much independent when it comes to these things. If the warrant is entered as extraditable, then it's a statewide issue. Then it's up to the governor's office to decide one way or the other. If the person is arrested elsewhere, he has to sign the extradition order. But as far as fixing these, no, it has to be a county-by-county basis.
So you're reporting on this. You're bringing this to people's attention. Have you gotten responses since this reporting came out saying, you know, we've got to change this, or we're planning to change this in our county or statewide?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the Portage County District Attorney had called it right away and said he's going to take another look at this. He was out of town last week and was not able to take a look before the story ran, but he will be taking another look, we've been told. Also, I've had some very good responses from Marathon County. I know that Ken Heimerman here is going to take a look at some of the cases as well.
And do you have plans yourself to follow up this investigation, see if things have changed in a month, in a year?
I certainly will. I think that our investigative team is really committed to following through and taking a second look after these stories have run. In fact, this original story ran almost a year ago, and this is an update when those numbers continued to go up. So we'll continue to follow that.
And the FBI are the ones who are tracking the overall national numbers on fugitives, it sounds like.
Yes, that's true. But those numbers, those names are entered at the local level. So,
All right, Shireen, thank you so much for joining us today and keeping us up to date.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Shireen Seewert. She's a reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin's media investigative team, talking about their ongoing reporting on fugitives from Wisconsin and whether they're being tracked and could potentially be extradited if arrested in other states around the country. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's the time of year when a lot of people are at the beginning of their New Year's resolutions. They want to do things like lose weight, save money, and get healthier.
There's one annual tradition, seems to be on the rise, could achieve all these goals. It's called Dry January, or Drynuary, or Janopause, depending on who you talk to. It's the practice of giving up all alcohol for the month of January.
Our next guest has practiced in Drynuary for the past 8 years, and he's in the middle of yet another Dry January. John Orr joins us. He's credited, by the way, with coining the name Drynuary. He's been writing about it for 5 years. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So going back to your very first Dry January, what you came to call Drynuary, what made you decide to do it?
Well, the idea really was born between my wife and I after, a typical festive holiday. We kind of came up with the idea of taking the entire month of January off as sort of a renewal and perhaps a cleanse from the holiday season where you typically are very social and you overindulge, and it sort of came up as a bit of a dare. You know, can we even do this? Is this something we're interested in doing? Let's make it more interesting than just a weekend. Let's make it a month.
So during that very first Dry January that you guys did, were other people doing it, or were you kind of out there on your own?
At the first Dry January or Drynuary, we felt like we were kind of on our own, to be honest with you, especially the reaction that we got from friends and family and other people that encountered us in our daily lives. We kind of felt like we had stumbled upon something unique that first Drynuary, you know, but as subsequent years would bear out, we clearly weren't alone.
What was it like? Do you remember? How did it go?
It was tough, for sure. It was tough. It was interesting. The reaction that we got from friends and family, as well as each other as we transited the month, was pretty eye-opening in terms of feeling like we were embarking on a bit of a marathon, as it were, since it was an entire month. It was difficult, don't get me wrong. We enjoy wine, and we enjoy beer at social events and during hockey games and so forth. So giving something up that, you know, occupies a, I don't want to say a central part of your life, but, you know, a significant part of your life at times, was pretty eye-opening.
It has caught on by the since those early days when you were doing it. Anne Hathaway, I just read in the New York Times, is observing a Dry January, a Drynuary. What do you make of the way that it's catching on with people?
I don't know if it's catching on so much as people are discovering that more people do it than themselves, perhaps. The fact that we weren't unique in our discovering of Drynuary, obviously, I feel like people in the United Kingdom have been doing this for years. Apparently, I discovered this year it's big in Nordic countries. Apparently, the Finnish call it whitening of the nose or something like that, but I couldn't prove that via Google. But it seems like it's a common sentiment that you want to sort of pump the brakes after the holidays and that you want to slow down and perhaps give yourself a chance to renew in the new year. So I'm surprised at perhaps the volume and the notoriety that it's achieved in social media and the media. I'm not necessarily surprised that so many people are doing it.
Alcohol is a big part of a lot of American culture. It's part of a lot of socializing, not just around the holidays. As you said, sports are one aspect, you know, watching playoff games, football, what have you, where, you know, people tend to drink a beer or something like that. Did it interfere with that aspect of your life, just the socializing and going out and keeping on with the normal stuff you do, but just without alcohol?
I don't feel like it interferes with it at all. One of the things that my wife and I made a point of during Drynuary was to sort of live our lives as normal and not hole up in our apartment and, you know, close the shade, so to speak. So, you know, we go out, we go to Broadway shows, sporting events, we go and watch sporting events or watch shows with our family and friends, and we throw ourselves right into the lion's den in many occasions where people are consuming alcohol. And I think that's kind of the point, actually, is to be able to remain stout in those situations and commit yourself to the entire month of Drynuary and not fold because somebody invited you to an interesting happy hour on a Friday evening.
Now, health benefits are one aspect of this, and apparently there are a lot of them. What do you think the body gets out of having a month without alcohol?
Well, speaking from personal experience, the things that I look forward to, and I honestly do look forward to January every year, the things that I look forward to are sort of this clarity, sleeping better, this losing weight is a terrific benefit that I experience and enjoy every year. It certainly helps with people who are embarking on New Year's resolutions to get more healthy. So I feel like there are some, you know, mental and physical benefits that I've experienced. And until recently, I think the jury was really out on whether or not there were physiological benefits. But I've seen some recent studies, for example, in New Scientist, that show that, you know, blood glucose levels and liver function actually do benefit from a period of abstinence like Dry-nuary, whereas previously I think the medicine was inconclusive on that.
Now, you do this each year, it sounds like, with your wife. Is it easier, do you think, if you have a buddy to do Dry-nuary with, that you can support each other and encourage each other?
Absolutely. The buddy system, I feel, is critical to Dry-nuary, so you don't feel like you're alone on this dry island, so to speak. We support each other. We, you know, share our triumphs, and we sort of share our dread at the same time during the month. And it's great when, you know, we're socializing or going out. We've got a partner in crime, so to speak, to order a soda with lime at a bar or something like that, and we don't feel like we're alone in this. And so I definitely encourage people who are going to embark on this to do it with a partner or get a friend or buddy up. But, you know, I've actually enlisted more of my family this year, and they're spread across the United States, and they're doing it as well for the first time, quite honestly. And so that really does help. And, you know, drinking is social, and Dry-nuary is social too.
Now, Dry-nuary does have its critics. There are people who say, sure, you don't drink in January, but then when you hit February, people go a little overboard because they want to congratulate themselves on observing a full dry January. Do you see any merit to critiques like that?
I honestly don't, and maybe that's not the most objective point of view, but I can tell you through my personal experience and those around me, people that I know that participate in Dry-nuary, that's just not the case. And it is a little frustrating and infuriating when people sort of come out of the woodwork to opine on your lifestyle and make critiques of your lifestyle that they have absolutely no insight into, and saying that, oh, you must be a lush the rest of the year, that's why you do Dry-nuary, and you're just going to binge in February. Look, I've gotten to a stage in my life, and I've certainly gone through enough Dry-nuaries where binging in February it's just not an option. It doesn't feel good. There have been Dry-nuaries where I've sat there on January 31st, and I'm like, you know, I want to go an extra week, perhaps. This feels really good. I'm really enjoying this. So I take those critiques with a grain of salt, in that they're typically made from afar with, you know, zero insight into my lifestyle and the lifestyle of other people participating, but it is a little frustrating.
Wisconsin is a state that has a lot of bars. Some would say that it has a big drinking culture that can be problematic sometimes. Do you think that something like this is, say, good for people maybe coming from a heavy drinking culture, or is it better just to learn moderation across the board?
I actually do think it's a good thing, and I would state that Dry-nuary and moderation across the board are not mutually exclusive concepts by any stretch of the imagination, and that sort of goes back to the point about people claiming that Dry-nuary participants just binge the rest of the year. That's not true. It helps teach you moderation. It helps infuse you with something you can carry through the rest of the year. And certainly in heavy drinking cultures, I live in New York City, there are a lot of bars, and it's a very heavy drinking culture here, absolutely. I think people can benefit from it, in that it helps you sort of recalibrate. It helps you pump the brakes. It helps you sort of reset yourself for the rest of the year. And quite honestly, if drinking is something you enjoy, you know, absence makes the heart go fonder to a degree. It helps you appreciate drinking in social situations, or with dinner, or having a good, you know, a good glass of wine with dinner or something like that, or special occasions. It does help you appreciate those more. So maybe abstinence makes the heart go fonder.
Do you think that it works and has benefits for even people who are not people who drink a lot? Maybe they have a drink a week or a drink a day. Do you think even moderate drinkers, I guess, can get something out of this?
I do. I don't think it really applies specifically to heavy drinkers necessarily versus moderate drinkers. I think it applies to anybody who feels like, hey, I could use a break. Or, you know, the holidays, again, the impetus behind this was the holidays, and the holiday season is overindulgence across the board. It's social, food, booze, everything. It's family. It's overkill usually across the board. And so being able to take a break from that and reset yourself, I think is beneficial. And even if you're, you know, a one glass of wine a week type of person, I think Dry-nuary can certainly have its benefits because it may make you appreciate that one glass of wine a week, having taken a break from it.
We're talking right now with John Orr about why he gives up alcohol every January, a practice known as Dry-nuary.
And we want to hear from you on this. Have you ever participated in Dry-nuary? Are you doing it right now, giving up alcohol for the whole month? Is this a good idea? Is this something you'd want to try? Is this something that we should do more of in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now about Dry-nuary, or the practice of giving up alcohol entirely for the month of January. Our guest is John Orr. He's in the middle of his ninth Dry-nuary right now.
And you can join the conversation right now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea, giving up alcohol completely for the month of January? How would that fit into your life? Or is that your life already? You don't drink at all. Have you done Dry-nuary? Are you doing it right now? What kind of benefits do you see from it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Rachel posted on Facebook, and she said, I'm doing this for the first time this month. Although it's been challenging, I think overall it's been a great way to detox after the holidays and to think more seriously and consciously about my health. I'm glad I'm doing it and very glad not to be doing it alone. I have a couple of friends who are doing it as well. Do you think that's true for you, John? Do you think more about your health, more consciously about it when you're doing something like Dry-nuary?
Absolutely. And the absence of something that you enjoy as well as something that you may partake in several times a week or whatnot is noticeable. And when all of a sudden the pounds start dropping off, for example, during Dry-nuary, you start thinking, okay, hey, this is a great benefit. Obviously, it's happening because I'm not having a couple of beers after hockey or anything like that. How can I then carry this into the rest of the year? How is this affecting my health? I really enjoy the way this makes me feel. How can I subsequently carry this forward?
Do you ever think that maybe it would be something worth looking into to just give up drinking? If you feel so good during Dry-nuary, why not carry it forward throughout the entire year?
Well, I think everything in moderation is a great thing. So Dry-nuary in moderation is probably a great thing as well. Certainly, I think culturally, Americans have a bit of a puritanical view of alcohol and its use. I think there's a bit of a stigma around heavy drinking. There's a stigma around alcoholism. It's sort of a binary on-off switch. And, you know, I think perhaps Dry-nuary might be a way to help ease people into the notion of doing something in moderation, even if it is taking a month off, so that you can infuse moderation into your daily life, with whatever it is.
Has it, do you think, strengthened sort of willpower muscles that, you know, might not be used for not drinking, might be used for something else? Do you think is a practice that does more than get you to stop drinking for a month?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. The fact that you can do it, and certainly the first one was the hardest, and once you've proven to yourself that, hey, this is something that I can undertake, I've got a partner in crime in my wife, and we look at it almost as a competition. Hey, you know, sometimes I try to go a day or two longer than her just to just to say that I did. So it does infuse, I think, a little bit of that willpower muscle, as you call it, so that you can carry that forward in your life and say, okay, where are other examples in my life where I need to exercise some willpower? Can I reach back to Dry-nuary and take some clues or some lessons from that and use that in my daily life elsewhere?
We're going to go to our phone lines now. We've got Arnie joining us from Arcadia. Hi, Arnie.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
Oh, I say I gave up in January of 1982, and I haven't gone back. I had my quota.
So did you feel like you were doing that as a response to the holiday season, maybe overdoing it heading into January?
Well, it wasn't just a holiday. It was a career of overdoing it. So I gave up, and things are much better now.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Arnie. And do you think, John, that happens? People use Dryanuary as a springboard to cut down overall. Maybe it's a good just launching point.
Yeah, I do think that. I think there are some schools of thought, certainly in the addiction and treatment community, that feel like bouts of abstinence like Dryanuary can be useful in embarking on a concerted effort to cut down on alcohol use or abuse. Certainly there's a movement called Moderation Management that has opined that a 30-day abstinence period like Dryanuary can be useful in infusing moderation into somebody's lifestyle and could even be a jumping off point towards, you know, actually denying the use of alcohol long term if that's something that they feel is in their best interest.
Now, there are message boards online, as you know, where people sound off about this concept. Some people are doing it and they want support. Some people have critiques again. And one comment that's been out there that we've seen is that other people, people have said that if you have to force yourself to abstain from alcohol for a month, then you're an alcoholic. What do you say to something like that?
I think that goes back to sort of my frustration and fascination with people who deign to, you know, opine on somebody's lifestyle from afar without knowing anything about that person. And it also speaks more towards the binary and, you know, what I believe is kind of a puritanical American view of alcohol use. It's you're either an alcoholic or you're not. You're either, you either drink or you don't. There is no in-between. There is no place for Dryanuary in their minds. And, you know, whether or not one can say that an alcoholic can actually physically do Dryanuary for 30 days and that doesn't make them not an alcoholic, you know, that remains to be seen. But, you know, I think it is a curious and frustrating part of the reaction to Dryanuary that people are who have no MD and, you know, maybe aren't even in the clinical psychology field and they feel like they're experts on somebody else's lifestyle just because I choose not to drink for a month.
So with your first Dryanuary, were there things about it that were harder when you practiced it that very first month than they are now? Because this is the ninth one that you're in the middle of right now. You've got a track record of these now behind you. Is it easier?
Yes, absolutely. You learn tricks and you learn sort of ways to navigate Dryanuary. You know, from personal experience, the third week is the hardest, quite honestly, and we're almost there. So, you know, you got a bit of a daunting bump in the road ahead of me, even in my ninth year. But the first year, absolutely. It was going to social situations where you commonly were used to having a beer or two or a glass of wine or something like that and not doing it. For me, I play sort of beer league rec ice hockey, which is, you know, has beer league in the name. So not having a beer with my teammates after a game is something I had to get used to. And it's doing that, it creates that willpower muscle memory that you alluded to earlier, and you carry that forward from year after year, and you develop coping strategies and even the ability to, you know, throw your teammates' mockery back in their face.
Do you think people are less comfortable around you when you're not drinking, but they are?
That's a really interesting point, especially if they don't know me. 9 years in, at this point, everybody who knows me know that I do this goofy thing every January, and they accept it, and they're used to it. But in social situations where somebody isn't quite as familiar with what you do, especially in a business atmosphere, for example, the absence of you drinking is noticeable. You know, so there's a whole etiquette around you ask somebody why they're not drinking because you might be afraid of the answer. You know, you find out they're in recovery. You know, you find out they're in their first trimester of an unannounced pregnancy. You know, you find out they're on some sort of scary medication that has interactions. So it is really interesting with people that don't know me, how they react when, you know, in a circumstance where it's absolutely understood that you're going to have a glass of wine with dinner at a business function that you don't.
I think we have time for one more super quick call. Anne on the Cross, hi.
Hello. I've been listening with interest to your program, and my main feeling is that I just feel sorry for people who think that they have to have a drink to have a good time. I quit because of medications 25 years ago, And I find that my family understands that. There's no problem there, but other
Anna,
people
I'm going to have
angry.
To. I'm sorry, Anna, I have to cut you off. We're short on time, but do you have to drink to have a good time, John?
No, absolutely not. And I think that's one thing that Drinery shows you, and that's one thing that we try to achieve is go out and socialize as normal. You can have just as good of a time, absolutely, without drinking. In fact, sometimes it's funnier to be around people who are overindulging when you're stone cold sober.
Well, thanks to Anne for her perspective. And John, thank you to you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with journalist John Orr. He's in the middle of his ninth Drinuary. His article about the subject is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Today is a birthday, sort of, here at Wisconsin Public Radio. According to my WPR calendar right up in front of my desk, today is the day that the radio station WHA was born, actually renamed from its experimental title 9XM.
That station is the early Madison-based ancestor of what we now know as Wisconsin Public Radio. And there's even a plaque downstairs that says we're the oldest station in the nation. Some people dispute that, though it may be the oldest continually operating station in the nation.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to argue with the plaque. It looks very authoritative. This is a serious plaque. And I gather it moved from the old deal at Radio Hall to downstairs at Vilas Hall. Weird thing, though, right? What happens when anything happens here? Somebody has a birthday, somebody starts working here.
Someone sneezes, we bring donuts.
Somebody buys donuts.
Right.
Did that happen today?
There were no donuts that I saw.
There were no donuts. Yeah, we forget, you know, this is a milestone, sort of, for Wisconsin Public Radio, but it's donut free. But maybe you out there can raise a donut and celebrate this milestone in the history of your public radio network.